SUAS News Podcast Series, where we interview newsmakers and discuss the news and applications relevant to the global unmanned technologies community. I'm your program host, Patrick Egan. We're not going to do any current events today. We're going to launch right into the subject here of the podcast and bring on our guest. Today's podcast is UAS Integration into Civil Airspace. This is going to be a good one. We're going to another Marianas Trench deal in the global airspace integration effort. So without further ado, let's bring on our guest, Mr. Douglas Marshall. He's the CEO of True North Consulting LLC and the author of this book, UAS Integration into Civil Airspace. Hello, Doug.
Good morning, Patrick. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been a really long time. Doug was on, for full disclosure, it was probably a long time ago because I've been on a little bit of a show hiatus, you know. It's my three jobs that I need to live here in California. But you were on, and we had you on, and you were was part of the series on the Drone Czar proposal. A little brief history on that is kind of a concept that I had, that we kind of had somebody that would act as kind of like the focal point or liaison between the, let's say, commercial sector or end-user sector, even bigger than just commercial, end-user sector and the regulator. And that's another good podcast, and you should probably listen to that. And after we go through this podcast, you'll understand why I nominated Doug as a possible Drone Czar. Because it's going to be interesting, and I know most folks, you know, there's going to be lots of elephant references. But before we get into that, Doug, for the benefit of the listeners, could you kind of give the listeners a little, you know, relevant bio of how you came to work with unmanned aircraft systems?
Okay, sure, Patrick. I'll try to keep this short, but I was just counting the years, and it's been about 18 years that I've been involved with unmanned systems. I left the law career. I retired from that after 28 years to transition to a teaching position at the University of North Dakota back in 1998. And I think around in 2004 or 5, UND got involved in both civil and military research and development regarding unmanned systems. And that was prompted by a markup or a grant or a contract actually implemented by then-Senator Byron Dorgan, trying to bring new industry and activity to North Dakota, but specifically to try to save a couple of the Air Force bases that were earmarked for closure. And so unmanned systems seemed to be a good way to step into that. And he actually proposed way back when that the FAA actually designate the entire state of North Dakota as a test range, which was at the time they thought it was preposterous, but actually the idea eventually evolved into the 8 test ranges that we have now. So my personal involvement with that was really from the beginning, just helping the Air Force and CBP at the time to develop some training programs for the Predator programs, and then helping with the bed down of the Global Hawk mission from Beale Air Force Base in North Dakota. And then the FAA had a sponsored program called CGAR, Center for General Aviation Research, with 5 universities involved, and UND was one of them. And one of the first opportunities they pitched to UND was research on UAS regulations that they might apply to unmanned systems. And I raised my hand and volunteered to undertake the project, and, you know, kind of the rest of the history from there. I've been involved in several FAA projects over the years and grants.
It's funny, you know, because I think about all of this history. I think we're going to have to start doing this dog year thing pretty quick. You know, well, how long have you? Well, I've been 3 dog years in this thing. So, I mean, I'm going to try and unpack some of this for the listeners because there's so much. And I know that you hear this all the time, too. It's like, oh, you know, drones are new. Oh, God, you know, this drone thing. And you know what? You can use drones to do X, Y, and Z, right? I don't know if you roll your eyes. I kind of roll my eyes and I'm like, oh, for the love of Pete.
No, I do. I read this stuff in the news and think, you know, these people that think that this is a new technology, you know, you're about 15 years behind the power curve there, and there's been activities going on for a long time here.
Well, and then, you know, it's like, well, Martin, you know, you were part of the first wave and the second wave and the third wave and the fourth wave and all that. And it's like, nah, you know, I'm not that old. Okay. Cause there were, waves in, you know, the 30s and 40s. And I think I did share that document from the Lockheed Missile and Space Corporation from 1976 with you, right? That 300 and some page report. People should, that is on, and that I think was RPA for civilian use, that story's on SUS News. And I did want to ask you about that. Now, I shared that with some folks. I shared it with PK at NASA, and I shared it with Jay Merkel at the UASIO. I never got any replies, but I thought it was pretty comprehensive, and I've heard Gene made the comments that he had heard a lot of those concepts and nomenclature and, let's say, to do tasks and whatever else. What was your takeaway from that 300-some-odd pages in a Cliffs Notes thing?
I wouldn't say that I, you know, read word for word the entire report, but I read enough of it or skimmed through it to understand that it was very prescient at the time. And in some cases, not much has changed since then. It was pretty amazing, actually. I really appreciate you bringing that to my attention because, yeah, this is nothing new. This is the technology and the ideas have been out there for a long time.
And even that report I found, you know, you probably, you know, I don't know if you watch $6 Million Man. I did as a kid. I love that show. You know, he's like wrestling Bigfoot and stuff. But it all kind of started out looking at, you know, NASA was doing research with remote control planes at a mothership and the lifting bodies. And, you know, because people are, this is another thing that people keep saying. They're like, oh, you know, this drone technology, you never had anything like this. You know, before it's like, no, you're wrong. You know, there was autopilots out there and there were people doing things and it did lead to the space shuttle and all the rest of it. So you're wrong. And that was before cell phones and all the rest of that. But even in that, there's a lot of concepts and we're going to go through some of that here because these are kind of like a Groundhog's Day integration thing. And so, you know, we were on the ARC together, the SUAS ARC, which eventually after 7 years became Part 107. And this is all building up to the punchline, which is going to be the book and where it is and why it is and why it makes sense. So, you know, when we were on the ARC, you know, even thinking about this other report, NASA, and all of the other ancillary work that's been done, and Access 5, and CIGARS thing you were talking about, and UND's been flying around for years, and we're going to get into the New Mexico State. We're going to get into all of this stuff. But, you know, the ARC thing, right? I mean, I really felt like we had already, I've been cleaning out the shed. That's another thing I've been doing this summer. I'm on the honeydew list. It's like, clean out the shed. And I've been cleaning out the shed. And there's a lot of history there, Doug, of stuff. You know, Were you part of the RTCA SC203 thing? I thought you were there. Weren't you part of that?
Yeah, I was there. Yep.
Because, you know, the guy, and I'm going to have him on, the CEO of RTCA, was like, hey, you know, what do you, maybe you could give me some insights into that standards thing. And I'm like, how long you got, buddy?
I got
lots of insights. Yeah, right? So,
I attended RTCA meetings for quite a long time until we had a meeting back in, I think, at the MITRE facility in McLean, Virginia, and there was like 150 people in the room. And we spent an entire day arguing over one or two terms. And I thought, you know what? I don't need this. You know, I can go off and do something more productive than this. It was crazy.
Well, that and there are other, let's say, standards shenanigans that go on. And that's one thing, you know, even with the art. Remember, the RTCA was the blessed effort. Remember, they were like, oh, RTCA, and they have this history, which they do. And I really want to talk about the DO variants. I'm going to have him on, and I want to talk about the DO variants for, let's say, certification for autopilot, software, partitions, you know, and we're going to do a deep dive on that one. That one ought to be fun about that, because you have the drone people are off doing their own thing. They've got like, oh, we're doing drone code, and we're going to, you know, you know, I don't know what drone code is. You know, we already have established standards. But anyway, so yeah, you're right. You know, so that was the established, let's say, or the blessed effort. And then I think a lot of people kind of came to the realization that you just had, or you shared. And the FAA was like, look, you know, we only have one vote here in the RTCA process. And you have a huge group of people, and everybody's got their dog in the fight. Everybody wants what they want, and we're not going to get anything done. So then we're going to go over here to RTCA, or I'm sorry, ASTM, which I know you were part of that too, right?
Correct. Yep.
Were you there when I
still an
left
ongoing
enough?
Process, of course.
Yes, it is. Like, were you there when I left in a huff? I've only left probably all of these efforts in a huff at one point or another.
At ASTM?
Yeah. Yes, at ASTM. Yep. And I left RTCA in a huff, too. You know, I know it's hard to believe, but I remember having a very spirited conversation with Jeff Goldie Goldfinger in front of the final stop. And God, where was I? I think I was in like North Carolina or something. But you probably remember at the time they were like, oh yeah, we're going to, you know, they're going to release the 107 thing, and it's going to be in the Federal Register. And then what you're going to do is it's going to reference, and you can pay the $75 and then you can go over and read the ASTM standards that will be part of the rule later, but those aren't going to be included in the Federal Register. You remember that?
Yep, sure do.
So, yeah, so Egan blew a gasket in front of the waffle stop over that one.
Yeah, I do remember that, actually, now that you mention it. I'd forgotten that. But, you know, I was chair of a work group for ASTM for operations over people, developing that standard. And it went on for 4 years, and I finally stepped away from it because we couldn't come to any kind of an agreement between the group that was doing the work and the representatives from the FAA. You know, they had a different concept of what they had in mind. And it was just a vicious circle of us asking questions and them throwing it back at us to be more innovative, I guess, in the approach. And then they became innovative and they said, well, no, that's not what we want. So at several meetings where I, you know, was up presenting to the group and said, with the FAA in the room, say, tell us what you want. You know, we got to have some direction here. And even after I stepped down, it took them another 3 years to actually develop the standard. I mean, it was crazy.
Well, and the standard thing is good, and you get with your peers, you know, and you're, and you know, everybody's like, it's like the parable. And I said, I warned everyone about the elephant references here. You know, it's like the five blind monks are describing the elephant, you know, and describes the trunk and the ear and the tail and all the rest of that. So it is good. The rub for me is that you do 15 or 17 years of standards work, and the FAA, you know, doesn't adopt any of these standards. They just adopted that RIV standard, which is a relatively newcomer in the standards thing. So, you know, that's my frustration. It's like, man, this turned into a career, you know, life, or let's say span, and you guys didn't, it's a two-way street, you know? You got to say, okay, well, we're going to adopt this, we're going to adopt that. That's one of my frustrations, and I don't know if you share that
it's the same, yeah. And there's a change in leadership both at the FAA and at the ASTM and other organizations, and they kind of take different approaches to things. And it's just sort of a never-ending closed loop, you know, where things really don't move forward like they could. And you've got a lot of really smart people in the room that, you know, have some great ideas and, you know, some real thinkers, and it's just frustrating to not be able to come to a conclusion on some of these things. Or when they do, then, like you said, the FAA doesn't adopt it or won't publish it or whatever the situation is. It's gets in the way of progress is the best way of putting it.
Exactly. And so, you know, and all of this kind of culminates into a frustration for me where, and I'm becoming more and more, and I think that we are seeing I don't know if I just want to call it politics or bureaucracy or whatever, but I think that we're really starting to see, when you look at the history of like NASA, when it was NACA, and, you know, the you're from California, and I'm sure you're going to remember all of the different aerospace companies that were here and the competition and the Century series of aircraft and things like that. That all seems to be gone now, and, you know, I don't think it's a good thing. I think that the progress and the innovation is really kind of slowed and been stymied by these political, bureaucratic type of efforts. And I understand there's a risk aversion or whatever, but on the drone thing, man, I mean, they went hard over, so hard over that, you know, we've seen the Chinese – basically, as far as I'm concerned, they basically just stepped in and kind of usurped the whole 107 envelope with their products. And I don't know, do you see some of that frustration that I'm talking about, or maybe you see it a different way?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Right, I do. My dad was, my father was an aerospace engineer and worked for McDonnell Douglas when we first moved to California, and then eventually to another company called Aerotronics, which was absorbed by two other companies a long way. Now it's part of Lockheed Martin, but the same kind of thing, a consolidation in the industry and a different way of doing business. And my dad's almost 97, and he still talks about it, how the industry changed so much, even since he's left, since he retired, that it's more profit-driven than it is technology-driven, which he finds really frustrating.
Well, exactly, and that was kind of one of the things that was – go ahead.
No, I was just saying they're so concerned about the bottom line and shareholder value and less concerned about big issues like safety and innovation and, you know, taking, you know, aerospace or aviation into the future. You know, it's just it's a different environment altogether.
Well, that's another thing that you're probably, you know, perusing that report that I said you had Lockheed did 1976. Gene was blown away on, like, you know, they have the cost of an aircraft. I want to say, you know, like the Cessna was, you know, $40,000 or less for a brand new Cessna.
Right.
And I'm like, what's it, you know, I think that 182 with the glass cockpits going for, I think it starts at $500,000, you know, which,
yeah,
you know.
Didn't surprise me.
Yeah, well, you know, it kind of cuts out a lot of the folks who can. Oh, here's another kicker on that one that you'll like is, God, I want to say that they said that the storage for an aircraft in a hangar for San Jose, this is the San Jose, you know, airport, was like a, I want to say, I don't know, kind of, I don't even want to misquote it. I don't know if it was a, I think it was 15 cents a square foot or something for a hangar space. It was laughable. to where we are
15,
today.
What?
Cents a square foot to rent.
Oh, a square foot.
Yeah, for hangar space to, you know, store your airplane. Sure. Not that way today. You know, you probably have people living in there for 15 cents a square foot, but whatever. I'm pretty sure it was 15.
Yeah, of course. Some people probably do. But...
Yeah, probably move here and living under the wing. And so, you know, some of the other stuff that you did, you were at New Mexico State, the PSL down there, which,
right.
You know, Doug Davis was down there. I remember I was working at White Sands, and I came over and did the visit, and, you know, they invested a lot of money. They had the airspace behind the Oregon Mountains there, which was also part of White Sands. But, you know, it was never... Even with the test sites and stuff, it was never, you know, I don't want to beat up on the FAA, but it never seemed to me to be something that facilitated innovation or integration. Fair statement, not a fair statement. What do you think?
Well, for the time I was there, I was just there for 4 years. The only grant or project that we had, or at least that I worked on, that even got close to that was a night vision study we did for NASA, actually. So flying drones against light support aircraft at night and just trying to generate a database for visibility of intruding aircraft and drones and, you know, what a ground observer or a VO could actually see at night. And that was a good project. We were out in the Hornado range, you know, in the southern New Mexico desert doing this and bumping up against cows while we were trying to work. It was kind of cool. But the rest of it was, it wasn't advancing anything that I could see. I don't know actually what the source of their money was to even run the place, but I left because they ran out of money to support the projects that we were doing. So,
right.
I would disagree with your statement.
When was that, just for reference, for the...
2011 through 2014.
There you go. And there was another 2011 story. Were you at Peter Van Blyenburg show in 2011 in Paris?
Yes.
Did you go that year? Okay.
I was a speaker. I think I was a speaker.
Okay. Well, you know, you probably remember I was there and I did a little grousing. I don't know if you remember that. I think at the time, the head of the UAS. Wait, was it still UAPO at that time, or did they change to UASIO when Rick Prosek was there?
Oh, you know, I don't remember, actually.
Blocking that out. It's a bad memory.
Well, I just don't remember the year. I mean, so much has happened. Trying to fix the time frame on some of these things is really hard, but...
Now the funny thing is he gets up there and he's like, we need data. And yeah, we're going to, and so, you know, you're given some of this background and we're talking back and forth about this background. And I remember I got up and I was like, hey, so what kind of data are you looking for? Maybe you remember this exchange. And he says, yes. Well, we're not quite sure. Do you remember this? Or am I jogging?
Yeah, no,
memory?
I do. Actually, now that you're saying it, you know, I hadn't thought about it in a long time.
So then I asked him, I said, you got anything? He's like, well, we don't know, and we haven't really figured out. I go, you got any idea, any inclination, anything jotted down on the back of a cocktail napkin? He didn't like that. He was a little upset about that. But, you know, I mean, guys like you and me, we'd already been, you know, this is 2011, and, you know, we'd already been, you know, the RTCA, the ASTM, you know. Yeah, RTCA for me was 2004, ASTM 2005, you know, horsing around with the FAA since, you know, like 2002 or 3. So at that point, you know, when people think it's like we're waiting a long time now, at that point, and you met, were you at the kickoff for ASTM too? Because you might have heard me grousing out there too.
For F-38, like, yeah, I was there actually, yeah. But
okay, so you remember.
Nelson Golding was running the thing, right?
Yeah, and remember, and Dan, it wasn't, no, it wasn't Dan Elwell, it was, who was the other guy that went over to certification? It was he was part of the EAA. And remember, he came out and gave us the F-37 rah-rah speech about how that LSA standard was going to save general aviation. And, oh, God, Earl Lawrence. You remember that?
Yeah, Earl Lawrence. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
So then they put the schedule out for what ASTM thought the meetings were going to be, you know, and yeah, we're going to be working on standards. And this is 2005, and the schedule was out to 2009 and on the paper. And I remember, like, you know, are you people crazy? This was me when I read that schedule, 2009, you know, I can't be a part of that. So, you know, anyway. That's funny that, Doug, you've been a witness to all of this grousing. I know who to call when I need someone to recall some of the grousing over the years, the integration grousing.
Yeah, yeah. You were it there. Goes way back. I mean, I've got boxes full of notes and folders and the rest of that from all these meetings. Literally, I've saved all this stuff, and someday I should put all that into another book, but... It's the whole history of this whole effort is almost incomprehensible.
I would agree with that. I've got a whole bunch of stuff too. Like I said, I read through this, the Beyond Visual Line of Sight Action Team, the, you know, yada yada effort, the, you know, somebody's gonna, you know, whatever. I mean, there were so many efforts that effort, money, and time were thrown at, and they were just dustbin, but not all of it. And then that's going to segue right into the book. So the book, again, is UAS Integration into Civil Airspace, Policy, Regulation, and Strategy. And some people who have been listening to the podcast this far will be like, well, you know, you didn't talk about the book. That's not true. What I was trying to do here was kind of, you know, Bob Fosse this and paint the landscape to the book, because, you know, I looked at it, I got on there, I looked at it, and I'm like, wow. And again, this was one of the deals like this, that we just had this memory lane thing and talking about all of these meetings and questions and all the rest of that stuff. We talked about it last time you were on. You said, oh, God, it took me a long time to write this. And, you know, and we know why, because we've discussed that. But what I would like you to do is kind of give us a, you know, the high altitude view of this book and let's say the mindset that you had going into it.
Well, as you said, I started on this project 11 years ago, really. It's almost embarrassing to admit that, but I had a publisher, Wiley, that was supported the entire way. They would ping me periodically and say, how are you doing on your book? I'd say, well, you know, I've got a version of it here, but God, I got to go back and revise half of it because things just changed yesterday. And I mean, literally, as I was finishing this book and discussing some EASA regulations and some efforts over in Europe, there was a change or an amendment to one of their regulations that came in like the day before I sent off the final transcript. And I said, you know, I can't keep doing this. I mean, it's changing so rapidly. I've got to have a stopping point and just close the book, and then maybe there'll be another edition or it'll be an online supplement or something. But it's so dynamic, and there's so many moving parts that trying to nail it all down into one book was really a task. And so it took me that long because the environment that I was writing about changed so much over that period of time.
Right.
I hadn't seen much written about, you know, the whole global integration effort. You know, you see bits and pieces in various books and articles and things that you've done and others have done. But it's all a kind of a conglomeration of efforts all over the world that are scattered. And it's really hard to get a handle on, you know, what's likely to really move forward, move the ball so that we can achieve whatever it is that the regulators and the users, airspace users, want to do with.
Right.
You know, well, and technologies.
And you're hitting, so those are some of the points too, because I think we talked about it last time. I thought about it, man, I got to memorialize this stuff, but it's the same thing. So, you know, that was one of the things. It's, and we might be jumping ahead a little bit, but pretty comprehensive as you do talk about South America, Asia, Europe, the EU. And then people are like, oh, the EU. And then a lot of people are under the false assumption that, like, all of Europe is part of the EU. What is that? I think there's 27 countries. Right. And then there's other people who are not members. Yeah, how many are there total?
There's 47 European countries and 27 are members of the EU. And the European Commission is the commission that actually created EASA, the regulatory agency, and then, of course, Eurocontrol up in the upper altitude. So it's a different process in Europe, as I point out in the book, and hopefully I explain it well enough. You got 27 members of the European Commission, and they're all sovereign states, and they all have their own ideas as to what they want. And you have Germany that has 16 states within Germany, and each state within Germany can, you know, do their own drone regulations, similar to what, you know, what happens here in the U.S. So pulling all that together is just an incredible organizational effort, and I think they've done a pretty good job for the most part. They've made some progress on UTM and U-Space and the whole integration picture, but, you know, they're years away from implementation. They keep pushing their implementing date back a year or two at a time, because part of it because of the pandemic, but others just because things have changed so fast. You know, the technology's come along, so.
And I do want to talk about that, too. I'd like to get a little bit of, you know, shine a little light on that. And the reason I want to do that is because, you know, and this is another thing that I think your book helps to do, is give people, let's say, the roadmap of, or you know, I don't know, maybe it's like a wiring diagram or something for these efforts. Because the stuff that you just kind of talked about, right, there's these inner mechanical workings. And people don't understand it. So every once in a while, and I'm sure you've done this too, or if you've noticed this, people are like, oh, you know, the Europeans are, you know, light years ahead of the Americans. And then they'll come back and they're like, oh, God, we're watching the light on the train. The caboose is going down the tracks, you know, over there in Europe. But you guys are leading the way. And yada, yada, right? So there's like kind of like people are jockeying for, you know, we're doing the airspace integration thing and we're killing it. The only thing I see is, you know, killing the domestic hardware market, but whatever. So I know, you know, and this would be kind of jumping way forward, but so, you know, you have the U-Space thing and you see all of these, you know, all of this crowing from Europe. Oh, we're going to have this and we're going to have that. And we're going to have U-Space and it's going to go and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And was it the woman from EASA that was the head of, EASA that said, we're doing it by 2023, it's going to kick off and it's going to be happening. And, you know, that's that deadline's approaching rather quickly. And as far as I know, there aren't the standards in place or the agreements in place to make that happen. Is that a fair assessment or am I behind the times on that?
That's correct. I mean, they have guidance materials and proposed standards and they've been published, but, you know, they're not the law there by any sort of order from the EU. It's still a working process. So it's not going to happen in 23. That's obvious. And you're going to see an order coming out here shortly that will extend the time another year, probably, if not longer.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, so that's why I tell people, you know, you hear this stuff, you know, it's kicking off and, you know, and anybody who's really investing in any of this and the flying car thing and all the rest of it, it's like, it's one of those deals like the Music Man, you know, where the guy came to town and he's selling people a false bill of goods. But one other, you know, we touched on standards before, and I think EASA put up some money to validate the 800 plus minus standards in the world. Did you see that? So I want to say it's like, it's close to 400,000 euros. Did you see that?
Yep. Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And so I kind of commented, more grousing from that Egan guy. And I kind of look at this from like a business perspective, but I'm like, okay. And we may have talked about this too in the past, but I, you know, for me, you got 800 standards, right? You got 400,000 euros. to find that up. And they want to have, they put out this tender to have people vet those standards. And my comment was, okay, so we're doing the old school thing here, right? So you're probably one of the guys that would fit into my idea that there's a handful of people on the planet who have been here long enough to understand, let's say, that whole history and process of the standards work for the integration of UAS into the global airspace system, yada, yada. You understand the twists and turns. It's in the book. There's a lot of history in here. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that you're on here today is so that other people can kind of learn this and why it's such a heavy lift. So in my mind, there's a handful of people that understand this, understand the law, understand the process, understand the history, yada, 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 right? And those handful of people, I want to say it's less than $400 a standard to vet the standards. To me, that's really not enough money. What are your thoughts on that?
No, it's definitely not enough. I mean, it's, yeah, there's a tremendous amount of work that has to go into not only understanding the history and the process, but having some sort of vision into the future as to what their goals are, what they think they can accomplish. And it's going to require a major effort to vet through all these standards. And if that's all they're offering, they're not going to get the right people, unfortunately.
No. And I think, you know, you just pretty much made the point I was getting at, because, you know, so, you know, you want right. I mean, some people like reading standards, you know, hey, great. You know,
yeah.
But it's almost like a forensic type of thing. Right. So again, you know, go back to the handful of people. You're going to read the standard. Oh, yeah, I remember this. I remember that concept. I remember when this was the stated goal of whatever regulator, if it was, you know, CASA or Transport Canada, or if it was FAA or whoever, right? And you remember the concept and the drive and when this was the goal and blah, blah, blah. So if somebody goes in cold, like you say, you pulled in some grad student, you know, pull them in here, read that standard, they're not going to understand all of those nuances. So for me, I'd like, you know, some person that has that level of expertise is not, one, going to spend the time to read the standard, and two, you know, are they going to peruse it and give it their stamp of approval and then put their professional reputation on the line all for 300 and something euros? I don't think that's realistic. You know,
it's not going to happen. They're going to have to appoint some sort of a super commission or some body of experts, you know, with a wide range of expertise who can sit down and have some authority on them, you know, to be able to just make the recommendations and suggestions and have the authorities that are running this operation respect it and take action.
Exactly.
You know, there's guys around that you and I both know very well that have been involved in this for over 20 years, well over 20 years, 20, 25 years. And, you know, they'd be ideal to sit on something like that to grind through it. Because, as you know, with your experience with RTCA and ASTM and other SDOs, you can put out any standard out there, no matter how well written, and somebody's going to pick it apart. They won't
exactly.
Like it. You know, it interferes with, you know, their business model or just some, you know, personal idiosyncrasy that they don't like the way it looks. And so if they have a veto power over it, then, you know, then it stalls and it takes years to resolve it. So that
exactly.
Whole public engagement process in and of itself is a science and an art. You know, how do you get people to have a common goal, which is, you know, in this case, safe integration of the systems? I mean, that should be simple, but it isn't for a lot of different reasons. I think it's a enormous task that they've undertaken.
It is. It is. And you're hitting on more points in this all here in the book. But the thing is, so those people that you're referencing, I mean, I could see their smiling in my mind. And
yeah.
A lot of those people that you just referenced have been described to me as people with sharp elbows. And yeah. I don't know if you've ever been in a meeting that Ron Vandalagraff, you know Ron? From now that guy, he was a government employee, but man, that guy could run a meeting. I remember being in a meeting with him, and that dude turned on a dime. I can't even say the stuff he said because it's a family show, but I was like, man, if we had more guys like Ron in government, things would probably be getting done. He's very good at it. I was impressed. I mean, I think
he's one of Peter Van Blindberg's favorite sons, I guess.
I think he told someone to shut the F up. Right. Yeah. Well, all right, we're going to get something done here. But yeah, so, you know, there are a few people out there that could do this. But again, huge undertaking. And for them to even put their stamp of approval on something is, that's a big lift. So, you know, as we go through this, and I hope people are understanding, I mean, you know, some of the stuff you said, you know, some of the standards are working with the regulatory body and all the rest of that. And I'm going to throw out an example right now. And this is probably something you remember from the ARC, okay? And you might remember, like, RCAP, we were talking about an under 4-pound exemption, which was, I mean, I even wrote it. I sat down with the AOPA guy. What was his name? It was on the tip of my tongue there. I also had HAI Dave York and Ellis. I can't remember Ellis's last name from ALPA. But
right.
Anyway, we sat down and Rob, AOPA was Rob. I can't remember. Anyway.
I remember the first names. I can't remember any last names. Yeah.
I mean, that's how tight we were. Anyway, as a group. But you remember, I remember, you know, Ted Weirzmanowski, there's another one, right? You know, and I'm still a little, I have a little resentment. It's like he never invited me to go fishing on his boat. Can you believe that? Son of a sea cook.
No, he didn't invite me either, so don't feel bad.
Okay, good. I thought it was personal. Anyway, so you remember he said, oh, yeah, the raven, you know, the raven falls apart, blah, 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 but, you know, the wings are covered in Kevlar. And that, so, you know, when you were talking about nomenclature, Kevlar set off alarm bells. You know, you had Dave York from HAI, which was a great guy. He told the good jokes. That was for sure the way he was very deadpan. But, he was a Vietnam helicopter pilot. As soon as he heard Kevlar, in his mind, that was bulletproof. Oh, if that goes into a tail rotor, you know, you're going to go in and blah, blah, blah. Do you remember that curve level?
Yeah, I do. Yep.
So that makes kind of the point that you just said. Just even nomenclature, even though that Kevlar is like it's thinner than a sheet of printer paper, that just set off alarm bells and then scared them and there were problems. So that's how fragile and delicate this process is. And then, you know, you have to deal with, you know, those guys kind of block together, the AOPA, HAI, ALPA guys. And all they think is, hey, we're doing this and our lives are on the line, and equivalent levels of safety, yada, yada, yada. And it just keeps going. On and on. Now we're going to run long, but I don't really care. Do you have the time to run a little long on this, Doug?
Sure.
All right, good. Because we got a long way to go. So, you know, you have the history in here, the IKO, which people may not understand, the Chicago Convention. There's a whole history lesson there. You got 50 plus countries involved. And it's kind of the international governing body, blah, 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 goes on. And then you start talking about the member states and you've got, you know, some of the stuff we talked about in the European Union, some of the stuff outside of Europe, you got South and Central America, and then you got Asia, and you've got all of these people trying to work together. And then this is going to be another way back thing. So when this deal kicked off, right? You probably remember the only people that really had any regulation for RPAS was CASA. Remember that Mal Walker gentleman? Do you remember that? And
they were pretty far out in front.
That had to be, I don't know, early 2001, 2, something like that.
Early part of it.
Yeah, and I remember thinking this guy is a total crackpot, this Mal Walker guy. But in retrospect, it would appear that Mr. Walker was, like you just said, way out in front on that deal. You know, interesting.
Yeah, they were. You know,
so
even Canada got in front of everybody else for a while. You know, they. You know, it's a huge country, but, you know, a relatively small population. And, you know, it seemed to, you know, the processes seem to work a little more efficiently in Canada than they do here.
I would agree.
They claim that they rely heavily on the FAA and our process here to kind of model where they're going. But, you know, they just got it done, which is impressive.
And I would agree with that. Now, I thought the Transport Canada was, I have to, and this goes back to that tug of war between who's leading the way and all the rest of that. Transport Canada, I thought, was pragmatic under the leadership of Karen Tarr. I'm sure you remember her, right?
Right. Yes.
And I thought she was approachable. Could talk to her. Hey, this is kind of, okay, well, great. Okay, you're going to need this. And blah. And it wasn't, I didn't feel like it was the shine on. You know, same deal with CAA UK. You had that Dobson and Whitaker. Those two guys were working together. I met them at Peter's show. I think that was 2008 or 9.
Right.
And I said, hey, you know, want to fly an unmanned blimp at the Olympics? Yeah, great. Sounds good. Come on over here. Let's talk about it. Sit down, you know. And again, it was not the shine on. And there's a lot of people that say, you know, I talked to Joe Bag of Donuts over at the FAA, and it turns out to be like a shine on. I thought that they were pragmatic, and I'm not, you know, talking my country down or whatever. It just seemed like more pragmatic. And maybe, you know, to be fair, you know, a lot of these countries, like you said, you know, Canada does have a very large population. There's not a lot of people flying around. And I know you did some Arctic work, you know, if there's a mishap, you might, you know, might make it a polar bear angry because you crashed near his range or whatever, you know what I'm saying? So it might be a little bit of a different animal than we have here in the United States. The other thing that we have here in the United States, I don't think the drone crowd really understands is the liability, commercial aviation liability. And I know in Europe there's like limits, you know, if there's a crash of a let's say livery aircraft, you know, and somebody dies, there's limits on that. And here, there are no limits. Am I correct on that, or did I get my wires crossed?
There are no limits for domestic flights, but we're part of an international, ICAO has a different system for an international flight. So it depends on where the accident occurs. Yeah. You know, there are limitations for international flights, but not here domestically.
So yes, there are nuances on all of that. So,
right.
You know, as we go through this, and we touched on the European thing, and so, you know, I mean, this is, and my hat's off to you on this too. I mean, you were able to do this in, you know, a relatively small book. So you must have sat there and really had to, let's say, parse a lot out. That's what I see in here, that this must have been a huge undertaking, especially if you spent that much time on it, right? And all of the history,
yeah,
all of the things that we've talked, yeah, about. So I mean, what was that like? You just have to like start going through there and jettisoning stuff. You're like, oh my god, what was that like?
Well, each one of these chapters, there's only 8 chapters in the book. Each one could have been a book of their own, really, if you really got down into the weeds. And so what I was trying to do in putting this book together, and you're right, it's a relatively small book, but that was intentional. I was just trying to give an overview of some of the major issues and make it readable. You know, it's, if you, an academic or in a college or university class or even high school, if a professor assigns a 500-page book that's just chock full of the stuff that we're talking about, nobody's going to read it. So this is sort of an introductory process and just introducing these issues to industry professionals and academics and researchers and other interested people so they can see where the issues are. And there's more to do after that. The book could have been three times longer than it was. Yeah, you're right. It took a lot just to parse everything and kind of condense it down into a manageable
manageable topic. Well, I got that right off the bat. That I was like, you know, wow, I was pretty impressed that you were able to kind of carve it down to that. And I would agree with what you just said. You know, your focus for academia and whatever else. So. One of those things I'm pretty active on, LinkedIn and Twitter and, you know, write stories and whatever else. And you have this historicalist perspective. But there is not something where people can say, okay, well, where do I go learn about this? You know, where would I go and get all the information and stuff you're talking about? Because it seems like it's so obscure and so abstract and it's too large to get your arms around, and that is what I think this book does. I think that you're correct. You know, hey, you want to know a history of where we're at here and how we got here? Here you go, without having to buy the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right. And I'm sure and other books have been written on that, you know.
Right. And it's comprehensive. I mean, you got the U-Space thing here, you have the UTM thing. I'm looking at, the pictures from the Reno thing, which I was at. And, so they have all of that. I think you got a really good, even better than just a high altitude view, because I think this is, if somebody actually, in my estimation, bought this book, read it, and were to say, like, go to one of the DAC meetings, I know they changed the name, but if you went to a DAC meeting or you went to one of the standards group or you went to it's a high level symposium, you would understand what they're talking about. I do not believe like at these, even the FAA's symposium or whatever, Joe Bag of Donuts goes rolling in there and, knows what these people are talking about. I envision it much to be like Charlie Brown's parents, because you couldn't know all this stuff. But I think that if you read the book, you'd have a pretty good handle. You could walk in and be pretty educated and understand. I'm not going to say you're going to understand everything, but you would be aware of the concepts in history. And I guess so that was your goal in putting this together.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good way of putting it. It's an introductory, it doesn't say that in the title, but it's introducing kind of the neophyte, the person that doesn't know a whole lot about this industry, to, I think, the major topics, the things that they need to be concerned about. And having a little historical context along the way helps. But then in the last two chapters, seven, which I really get into the processes for assessing risk and, the various elements, the safety issues that are inherent in these systems, or the airspace system as well as the technology that flies in it. And then chapter eight is cybersecurity, which I think is a huge topic. It's not being, I know it's being dealt with, but you don't see a lot written about it. And there are conferences and meetings all over the world that people are concerned about it. And I think that the vulnerability of all of these systems to hostile actions by, bad actors is a major barrier to any of this working. It's not going to be successful. Airspace integration until they can solve the security issues.
I would concur with that. And those the technology, I think this is something that other people, and again, the newcomers, and you were talking about others' turnover and things like that. So a lot of people wrongly believe I go to Best Buy, I buy a drone, and 3 months from now, I'm an expert. I know, I pretty much know everything there is to know about droning, and some of the things that you're talking about. So there's cybersecurity, there's vulnerabilities with the technology. People don't understand how intelligence gathered. You got one part of that. You got bad actors. I mean, there's people. I'm not really a software guy, but they can spoof the RID already. They can spoof the command and control. There's all of these different things that could be done. And you could go out on Reddit and buy these downloads and do all kinds of different things with these commercial drones. So I think that people are underestimating the risks, over confident in the technology. And that even goes into the AAM thing. You know, it's like I'm working for some other people on another contract, and it's like nobody really even knows what's going on frequency-wise in these major metropolitan areas. Did a lot of flying in San Francisco being an art teacher, and in different parts of town, there are offices, and there are what I would call just frequency saturation. Wi-Fi, 1.4 gig, you got your 5.8, you got all of these different, and you'll have video dropout, you have command and control dropout in relatively short distances. And I don't think anybody knows about that, or even the multipathing from GPS. I've seen it myself near buildings where these drones will shift position. The other thing that these guys write in the code for the open source order autopilots, again, we kind of talked about some of that certification. I've watched this stuff with my own eyes. You've got eddies over, natural geography, trees, buildings, whatever. And the real world situation, the autopilots can't handle them, and these things fall out of the sky. And hopefully you're not doing that over people, right? So I think that there are some misconceptions about the technology. And I know that there's frustration with the beyond visual line of sight. And I think that you can do beyond visual line of sight, if you agree or disagree, in certain areas. Like you say, there's a risk analysis that you could do. And you can say, we're out here in Corn Bluff, Iowa, and you want to fly a one-pound drone that has an endurance, so you could fly it for 5 miles, whatever. You can figure it out. But everybody wants to fly in downtown L.A., off the bat. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are doing that. In fact, almost all of them are doing it without authorization or even competency to do it, even if they were authorized. The FAA can't stay up with the demand in the user community, and the technology itself is not staying up with the desires of the users. There's a new development. It seems like every day, you put them on your website, and there's other news consolidators that do the same thing. There's not a day that goes by I don't see something that says, "Wow, okay, there's something new." Or there's a threat that I wasn't aware of, or there's a piece of technology here that may solve that one small component of the threat risk. It's amazing how dynamic it is. It really is. It's just extraordinary. But I think the whole system, the whole environment is incredibly vulnerable to disruptions and shutdowns. And, if North Korea wanted to, they could probably shut down our air traffic control system entirely with the push of a button.
Right.
I mean, that thought scares me. With 3,000 airplanes in the air at one time, all of them seeking an airport somewhere. And, that's crazy. It scares the heck out of me.
Well,
it would be an act of war to do something like that, but still.
Well, and I agree. And there are a lot of vulnerabilities. And I think, the other thing is what we're seeing transpiring in the Ukraine. I mean, we've seen bad actors use this is another thing that always kind of gets my goat, and this is a little bit of moral riding that I think we've done here in this country, and I'm sure it happens in other Western countries too. But I remember ringing the bell, in 2008 or 9, saying you could have $1,000 Chinese UAV. People laughing me out of the room, or that the Iranians have a domestic drone program and being laughed at. There's no way they can do that. There's crippling sanctions. And I'm like, well, here they are. Here's pictures. No, it's not going to be a problem. And now it's this problem. And I think that we're really behind the eight ball. You talk about vulnerabilities. You know, there's some tests they're going to do, the military is going to do, where they're going to, like, simulate, you know, 40 drone swarm attack while the Chinese are doing drone shows with 5,200 drones. You know, right. You're going to have to be cast in a wide net for that. So, you know, those things need to be come to terms with. And then that is one of the other frustrations I have with the regulatory side of this, is I think what's happening is there's been an artificial brake on the wheel here in the United States, and people, you know, we're not building our own hardware, we're not building our own solutions for these problems. Would you agree or disagree with that?
No, I agree. It's too much of what's foreign made, and you don't know what's been embedded in some of these systems. You know, a clever developer or programmer can embed a, you know, worm hole into a computer chip, and it's almost virtually undetectable until the worst happens.
Exactly. And so the last point I want to hit on here, because this is also in the book, and I think that this is a progression from, and this is one of the things that I kind of laugh at too. So we have the drone, or UAS, or RPAS, or whatever you want to call them. Many names, same thing. And then we have that progression, and now we're getting into this advanced air mobility and the flying cars and all the rest of that. And I remember asking Joe Ben, you know, Joe B, aviation guy, back in 2018, they asked me to come to this thing because I asked these hard questions. And I said, hey, look, you know, we've been working, you know, for a long time on trying to integrate now what I would call the 251-gram drone into the NAS, full integration, right? And you guys are talking about this new technology, new fuel source, new concept, which is not really new, but, you know, whatever, we'll call it new or whatever. And you guys think you're going to, you know, get this into the airspace when? Oh, you know, we're going to have a type certification by 2020. And I just was chuckling. And I'm like, okay. Right. You know, I don't want to be Debbie Downer. But you see the people jumping into the drone thing and right into the AAM thing. I mean, are these guys dreaming 20 years, 40 years, billions?
I think it's a pie in the sky progression. I, you know, 2030 is unrealistic in my opinion, because the global community is so far away from solving the problems and coming up with the proper solutions to make the system safe. I can't see it. I really can't, not for another 20 or 30 years at the earliest.
Yeah.
You know, unless something extraordinary happens, I don't know what that would be, but
well, and
it's crazy.
But this, okay. So, you know, in chapter 7 in the technology thing, you talk, I mean, here, this is the stuff that these, you know, you have the flying car companies are like, oh, they're going to be, how we're going to make it petrolless is they're going to be autonomous. It's like, what dispensary are you buying your weed from, man? That's all I could think of, is because we don't even have that for the 251-gram drone, right? I mean, you have right, the detect and avoid and sense and avoid capability, autonomous operations, the beyond visual line of sight. You know, is it going to be RID, ADS-B, transponders? I mean, are you going to have all these things flying around willy-nilly? So there's a lot of these things do overlay. And I think that people even getting into the AAM thing would benefit from reading this book, because I think that they would, especially if I was an investor, if you're an investor in a flying car company or drone company, drone delivery or whatever else, before you're going to dive off, you should read this book and get educated. And that's my opinion.
Well, yeah, read chapter 7 and 8. I mean, you know, I raise a lot of questions. I don't offer any solutions. Just these are the things you need to be thinking about. And the risk assessment and the oversight process goes from, you know, at the top level, the global airspace system, down to computer chips. And the people that design them. And I mean, there's so many layers of concern where there are not the processes to fully vet the risk issues along the way. You know, it's going to take years to sort all this out. Maybe artificial intelligence will fix it also, but not now.
Right. I got misgivings about the AI. But, you know, that's a whole other show. So, okay, so in closing, you know, where you know, you said you didn't have any solutions here, but I want to hear this silver bullet, Doug. I want to hear, like, if you do X, Y, and Z in 2 weeks, we'll be fully integrated in the NAS. Do you have any magic tricks for us there?
You know, if I was an investor, I'd want to be asking these questions. Let's put it that way.
Especially if you're betting the retirement money on it, right?
Right, exactly. You know, I wouldn't invest in any of this unless I could get all those questions answered.
Exactly. You'd be staring down the barrel of dog food in the trailer in Barstow.
Yeah, exactly. So,
that's about all you got. All right, well, I mean, we covered a lot. It's funny, you know, we covered so much history of this, but that all of this, I mean, if you're, you know, if you're in this industry, it's in the book, get educated. You're going to know the trials and tribulations, the pitfalls, and what needs to be done. So my hat's off to you for even taking this project on and helping to educate the rest of us. I have been asked in academic situations, is there a book? I mean, is there, you know, and I'm like, no, one doesn't really exist. And I think that you hit the mark on this one, Doug.
Well, thank you.
I hope so.
Yeah, if not, exactly. I'll have to do a second edition.
Exactly. Well, like you said, I think you could do a book on pretty much every one of the chapters and turn it into, you know, this Encyclopedia Britannica deal. You could probably sell them door to door.
Yeah, I'd have to hire a whole team to help write it because I don't have the time.
Exactly. All right, well, I appreciate your time today, and I'm sure we'll be talking in the future. The links now. Let's do this real quick, but in closing, because if people are like, "Oh, get out! I want to buy the book," and so the easiest way to buy the book is they can go to your website, which is
www.truenorthconsulting.org.
Okay, and there'll be a link on there, or you can go to you can buy it at Amazon and search it, right?
Right, and then Wiley, it's wiley.com/buy/978111833-9497. But if you publish anything on this podcast, that's the website for a direct buy from Wiley. But yeah, it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, you can.
But there's a direct link
search
on my website. Yep.
Okay. So yeah, there's multiple ways to get it. And I'm gonna put a story together for this, and all the links will be in there, and you can. Listeners can go there and buy and get themselves educated. Which I think, if you really want to be in this business, you should get educated. It's one of those deals. There's an old joke about how to make like $1 million in aviation. And it's like start out with $2 million and work your way down to $1 million or whatever.
Yeah.
I forget what it is exactly, but that's it.
Yeah. Or buy an airline. Watch it go in the toilet.
Exactly. All right, Doug. Well, thanks a lot for your time today, and we'll be talking in the future. And thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks, Patrick. Have a good day.
You too.